coming to you from the desert southwest, deep beneath the sands near a place called Roswell. We are about to chew into a black box of disinformation, conspiracy, and alternative theories on a variety of subjects. Welcome. You have now tuned into the Rat Files. For the next hour, your lovely host, the Mouse, and her co-host, Lance, will take you deep down the rat hole, beyond the cover stories, the mainstream media hype, and the superficial but generally accepted consensus that most of the surface world believes is absolute truth. These are the Rat Files. Welcome to another great Rat Files podcast. Each week, the Rat Files team dives deep into various alternative topics to bring you the best in fresh investigative reporting, stories that seek to inform and enlighten you, the listener, with better coverage of the topics you want to hear about. We invite you to visit our website, theratfiles.com, where you can access our podcast, find information about the Rat Files, and have easy access to other links like Facebook, our email, and local maps if you're planning to visit Roswell. Our homepage also has links to our merchandise store where you can find lots of great Rat Files stuff too. With that said, let's begin our next show.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another great Rat Files episode. Tonight, we have lots to cover, but before we get started, I wanted to mention just a few things. First off, I have to say that the Roswell summertime has kicked into its normal pace of hot and sunny.
Actually, a little above normal. Oh my, yesterday was 114, so...
Yeah, it was a little warm. And for those that are planning to come to the UFO Festival at the end of this month, or to the Sci-Fi Festival... Also running concurrently with it, visitors to our area who are not used to the hot, dry desert climates, make sure you study up a bit on being safe and comfortable in our climate so you can actually enjoy your time here. While Lance and I were out the other day working on some podcast research, I have to say it was a real scorcher. When we got back in, he put a small heat and preparation section into our events and links page for anyone visiting our site to see. Now, not everyone is used to the desert heat and environments, and we know that. So, if you're not used to triple-digit heat and very, very low humidity, almost zero, you might want to take just a few minutes and study up on how to be safe in it. Keep in mind, a lot of the UFO festival itself is being outside, and whether it's walking from site to site or the street fair-like environment or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, we can cook in it.
You have to be careful.
We can do a three-minute egg in a minute and a half on the sidewalk here. So just trying to be informational to everybody. We're, as everybody can tell that's listened to our podcast, we're really eager and excited for the festival. It really is a fun outdoor festival event with a large crowd, very large crowd. And for those that may not be ready for our kind of heat here, we really want to make sure heat casualties are a minimum. So,
and also allergies. People need to be aware that even with me living here, I'm dealing with allergies on a daily basis.
We are a huge, we are the nation, one of the nation's largest pecan growers, and pecan tree pollen and the results of that are astronomical, not to mention you've got a lot of persistent things like mesquite, which are aromatics, and you've got basically like a ragweed.
Though it's hot, we have the windstorms that blow stuff up from other areas.
And there's nothing like a 100-mile-an-hour straight-line wind to blow like 4,000 tons of dust out of the desert into the town. So
exactly.
You can see when the sky turns orange. Again, all these wonderful things contribute to allergies and stuff. Yes, we still like living here, but you just have to be used to a few of the nuances of the weather here. So not everyone comes out from Phoenix with the attitude, wow, look at the nice, cool weather you guys have. Yesterday was a Phoenix day, actually.
Excuse me. Yes, definitely.
So they definitely wouldn't have been saying that yesterday.
And I was out walking in that weather.
I know, that was well, I did too, but I did it before 9 a.m. So.
Oh, no, I did it at the peak of the heat.
On the serious side, and like I mentioned on our events and links page, the local press is predicting upwards of 50,000 tourists and visitors for our festival, multiple festivals we're having, possibly more. They're calling for one of the biggest festivals we've had to turn out for the UFO and sci-fi festivals at the end of the month. And with only, actually, less than 2 weeks of time remaining now, time draws near for great fun, lots of entertainment and information. There are speakers across 3 days. The agenda for the speakers we've put up on our site, too. You can still plan your trip, but act fast, because motel rooms, I guarantee you, are almost gone. And we have a lot of RV parks in the area, too, but they're probably booked as well. Once here, enjoy the food, the sights, the evening entertainment. Stay hydrated and definitely stay cool while doing it.
And on another note, we've had lots of positive comments about our podcast presence on Dark Matter Radio. I'd like to thank Keith Rowland and the crew at Dark Matter Digital Network for their help in getting the Rat Files out to you, our listeners.
You can actually catch the Rat Files podcast on Dark Matter Radio Digital Network Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Adjust for your local time zone. And for our European listeners, that's 0100 UTC for European listeners, or 0200 Greenwich Mean Time, I believe, for London itself. Who can access Dark Matter via internet radio. We're also on again Sunday nights, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, or 0400 UTC. So if you want to catch it again, he's doing some loops through the night on that and using that to fill some dead space he had. But again, anything is great to get our podcast out there. He's got a great show. He's got a lot of good shows on his channel. The Midnight in the Desert, the Dark Matters Digital Network, for those that are really big Art Bell followers, know that that is the last. Keith had actually set that whole thing up for Art Bell originally.
Exactly.
So they've got some really good shows, really good speakers out there other than us. So definitely tune in and give them a listen. You can also catch us on the Dark Matter during the early part of the day on Fridays and Mondays as well. So tune in at work or whatever and show your friends what you're listening to and coworkers. Make sure to check out Dark Matter's other shows, like I said. And you can tune into them through their homepage at darkmatterdigitalnetwork.com. Not Dark Matters, but Dark Matter, as in the universal material, digitalnetwork.com.
Right.
Listening to them through internet radio is, of course, free, and you can sign up with them from their homepage and become a member. Also, we wanted to give a shout-out to Wes and Woody and the crew over at Sasquatch Chronicles, who does all things Sasquatch, and they do them real well. He's linked us some of our shows over to his homepage to share with his listeners, and until I can find a moment of time to add him into our links and everything, to return the favor
which
to him.
Which we will do.
Our links page is about eat up with the Roswell festivals right now. I don't know that anybody could really find it on the links page unless they really went browsing.
And I really want to add that I do believe that it was because of Wes and them with Sasquatch Chronicles that we actually got our sixth continent.
Yeah, we picked up Africa, so we've got everybody but Antarctica now,
yay,
of listeners. Which was amazing. We did pick up Africa, so we've got it all. We're heard on six continents now, and we want to thank everybody out there: Dark Matter Digital Network, Sasquatch Chronicles, and of course all the listeners that are tied to all three.
Exactly.
For making the truth about giants. What's up with giants, or the true giants? A great podcast. It has definitely zoomed to the top, or almost the top.
Yeah, True Giants has definitely.
It hasn't beat Ancient Giants yet, but it has really just.
It's right behind it.
I can't believe they haven't shut down the podcast server over Buzzsprout yet for that. It has gotten overwhelming response, and thank you so much for all the popularity on that. We've got some other really great shows coming in the near future.
And I have gotten my first shirt from the new merchandise store, and I want to thank everybody else who has ordered already. And if you haven't got your Rat Files stuff, go get it now.
Yeah, definitely visit our website, visit our merchandise store. Unlike the way a lot of people make money and keep their podcast or projects going, some do it through selling advertisements. You notice you don't hear an advertisement on the Rat Files. We don't do it through a Patreon or any kind of asking for money from anybody.
No.
The way we have any operational funds at all to pay the monthly podcast bill and the equipment and everything is through selling merchandise through our link, through our store link. Visit theratfiles.com, buy a t-shirt, buy a mug, and help us out, be able to keep providing the show to you on that end. It does get kind of pricey on having to do some things like pay for monthly podcasts, especially if we do a lot of show releases.
And it also helps us offer things like our giveaways. It helps us offer the brochures that we give to the different areas. So, yeah, help us out if you want. Just go over and visit. We're not asking for nothing.
With the merchandise show, you get something for helping us operate. You get a coffee mug, a t-shirt, backpack, whatever you want.
A mouse pad.
There's lots of stuff in the merchandise store, so give it a look. And actually, after all the festivals are over here in Roswell, to flip back on what I was saying, I intend to link everyone out on our events and links page once I get that cleared up from the festivals. But it is, again, rather busy right now.
So now let's turn to our topic of discussion tonight here on the Rat Files. We normally wouldn't run so many cryptid shows back to back.
Yeah, we jump in there normally with conspiracy or legend or something else. But we've really got on. I've got so many of these folders on the server. We've got to get some of them.
And
all.
I just keep finding more.
Yeah.
But you know, since we didn't mention this particular one on our last podcast,
and it ties into not only the last but the one before it as well,
and the work on it was pretty much almost complete, we went ahead and decided to prepare this one for release, as it somewhat ties into our last one, True Giant, and thought our listeners would appreciate keeping it all together, especially for any out there who are into the general topic of cryptids like I know Lance is.
Absolutely.
Almost as much as I am. Not quite, though. Now, as for our topic tonight, we've heard the word many times. Several movies have made, you know, different showings and representations of this topic. But what is it? What are we really talking about when we say Wendigo? And is Hollywood correct when they frame this creature, or are they way off as to what it really is? Lance, you and I both worked on this research about this particular creature, but I know you had a lot of the info already put back. So take us into the background and the history of the Algonquin Wendigo, and bring us up to the modern version, often referenced today.
Sure, Mouse. And before I even get into starting on our podcast presentation, I have to say, even until last night, I was still finding conflicting information on this topic. And I was looking and browsing and trying to find kind of a lead-in, a tie-in, how to introduce it. The Wendigo, or Wendigo, depending on how you pronounce it, is based in some ancient Native American First Peoples myth. And it's kind of unique in the fact that what they speak of is absolutely not what Hollywood has shown us.
No, definitely.
Hollywood has taken the concept of a couple of things and wrapped them up for convenience and, boo, you're scared. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the creature that actually the native peoples believed in.
Which, by the way, Hollywood's showcasing of this creature does not match any of the original writings that I found.
Anybody that, if you go on the internet and do a search for the word Wendigo, one of the first images that'll pop up is a decrepit, rotting deer corpse-like bipedal creature with bells in his antlers, and he's walking along, but he's a cannibalistic or carnivorous deer. None of this actually comes out in the legend. So
no.
if the first thing you see is a bipedal carnivorous deer with rotting velvet on his antlers and bells tied in it and all this, you're picking up what is considered the most modernistic I guess, native myth of this, combined mostly with Hollywood hype. That creature did not and does not exist in the most ancient tellings of the Watego, the Wetico, the Wendigo, the Wendigo, however you want.
It actually has hundreds of names.
It has hundreds of names, and the funny part is the deeper you search into Native American lore for cannibal giant, those two words, cannibal giant, and you're doing it within the scope of legitimate Native lore, you find that this thing goes back prehistory. So the Natives knew about this creature for a long time, and they were terrified of it. It was, some believe it, that in a few instances it may have been referencing Bigfoot, but most believe it's speaking of something far larger, far more violent and hostile. And if this sounds familiar, that's because it's tying back into the True Giants. And again, that's why we decided to run this right on the tails of True Giants, because we've got a lot of questions
they
in this one.
They kind of go together, well, even though they're kind of different.
We got some questions. We've got some information for you tonight. So first, we want to point out that the podcast ties into a lot of that. And again, the information we have on giants, trolls, Bigfoot, ogres. So for a better overall view, you may want to go back into the Rat Files archives. Give a listen, if you haven't, to a few recent podcasts, like True Giants, if you haven't heard it yet, to get a better view of our overall topic tonight. For tonight's topic, the Wendigo, or Wendigo, we have to, the reason I, by the way, anybody that's wondering why I say Wendigo, because the actual native, the Algonquin pronunciation or spelling that we have when we first translated it to our mutilated English was W-I-N-D-I-G-O, which is
right.
Wendigo. We, somewhere or another along in time, as English, threw an E in there and called it Wendigo, putting the emphasis on the second syllable. I haven't found that to actually be what the original word was. So,
but that's the way I always heard it, so I kind of can't break myself from it.
And
so.
I actually have, from having to reread it over in my mind over and over again doing this research, is to me now, where I once called it a Wendigo, now I'm calling it a Wendigo in my head because I keep seeing it spelled W-I-N-D-I-G-O. So bear with us again. This is just part of the confusion on this creature. And again, we have to explain a few of these things to everyone, almost no one is familiar with this creature, unfortunately, due to our horror-driven American senses. We've been done a great disservice by Hollywood on this specific creature, as time and time again, the errors and stereotypes of one book written a century ago has in fact become the de facto standard for what this creature seems to be, when in fact the Anglo-American writer who wrote it, Algernon Blackwood, who wrote the book Wendigo, and it was released in 1910, I heard that he wrote it in 1907 actually, but he did not use very much of the native lore about the actual Wendigo to write the book. The book is more, unfortunately, and I'm afraid, is filled with stereotypical accounts of natives, white men, French trappers. In 1910, he's trying to recapture a century prior, what I call the mountain man days. He's doing a last grab at a lot of the stereotypes of each kind of man and puts them in a little hunting soiree for moose.
Right.
And in the end, it's all about the interactions of men and their fears, not anything about the monster. And yet we took the claim of what the book says little about the monster accurately, and Hollywood has framed a creature out of it to scare you that if you really read the book, you're left with, why?
there's some definite whys.
It's a 107-year-old book, so this is not really a spoiler. I'm going to summarize what the book's about here. If you haven't read the book, it's available in any public library. It's called The Wendigo by Algernon Blackwood. In Blackwood's book, we read about the characters of the story, a Dr. Cathcart and his nephew, a divinity student named Simpson, after they arrive in the Northwest Ontario woods to hunt moose. They're joined by guide Hank Davis and Joseph DeFago and the young camp cook referred to as Punk. Now, in the telling of this tale, Cathcart and his nephew, Simpson, are Scottish. Cathcart is on a hunt after northern moose, and Simpson, his nephew, being a good-natured tenderfoot, simply wants to get away from the city with his uncle. Davis is like an old prospector. You can picture an old, weathered old man, cranky, crotchety, He's familiar with old school wilderness. He's a master of creative cussing. You can think of him as an old retired sailor is the way I envisioned him.
Scruffle beard.
And his cohort trapper, or his cohort guide, is Defago, who is a French Canuck, as the book describes him, steeped in woodcraft and the lore of Voyager ancestors. Think of him as the ephemeral hunting trip guide. He speaks French, he's burly, he's strong and powerful, but he has a Spanish complexion and a twist to that. So his passion for the wilderness always cures him. He gets depressed when he's in the city, and he straightens right up when he gets back in the woods after a few days, as a lot of us do.
Right.
And Punk is an Indian. He come across like some young post-adolescent, young man. Book describes him as an Indian. He's a native person, Native American, of indeterminate nation. They never state what nation he's with. I would assume Algonquin, but it's never stated. And stereotypically painted as keen to nature and very superstitious. This short blurb is really far more than most of the description that the Wendigo gets in the whole book. See, in Blackwood's book, he shortchanges the telling about the monster to set the stage for fear and loathing over what happens to this motley hunting troop.
Right.
Again, the less said about the monster, the more it leaves to your imagination. The problem is Hollywood took that and ran with it in four different directions. Early on, Defago has nightmares of the Wendigo. It comes for him. Defago disappears, and days later he reappears as you are told that the Wendigo lures you away into the bush. You chase it, your feet turn to fire as you speed after this elusive creature. Eventually, your feet turn into looking like the Wendigo's feet. But fear not, because the Wendigo only eats, and I get this, the Wendigo only eats moss.
I'm sorry, I had to laugh at that.
I did too. Even though it lures men to their madness and eventual death by consumption over a few weeks' time, they wither away, they fade away. So in other words, the Wendigo isn't even cannibal in this book, according to Algernon Blackwood. But keep in mind, this is what Hollywood has taken as the model for the Wendigo and actually went back and grabbed some of the original traits, such as being a man-eater. I refuse to use the word cannibal when I'm looking at a two-legged creature walking around with antlers.
That is not a man.
That is not a man. That, therefore, can be cannibal. It can be a carnivore, but it cannot be a grizzly bears are carnivores. They are not cannibals. So, see, the fears are phantasmic. It's made to leave gaps so you jump to conclusions. It's a book, and
right.
It's written in the old school, the classical way of writing a fiction novel. But in reality, and sadly, this has been transcended into most every story that Anglo-Americans have ever told about it, which are quite a few and quite diversified, as could be expected. It is, in fact, the monster we don't understand enough to be that afraid of it. If you ever wonder why there aren't more movies on Wendigo, well, you know, boo, there's a warble. See? Didn't scare you, did it? You have no clue what a warble is.
I was about to say exactly
so
what
how
is
can,
a warble.
So how can me going, boo, there's a warble, scare you if you have no clue as to really, your mind has nowhere to jump to a conclusion? Same problem here. The Wendigo has never been properly explained out of the Iroquois and Algonquin legends to white men to give you actual fear. I mean, we have been given the Wendigo a few times in American modern horror, such as shows like Supernatural, Season 1, Episode 2, where Sam and Dean Winchester take on the Wendigo, on his own hunting grounds, no less, in the forest. In general, they paint him as a wind monster that phases in and out of solidity. I'm talking with my hands, aren't I?
Yes.
Mouse reached over and grabbed my hands because I'm flopping around.
And I'm about to get hit.
Right. and drags people underground to store them for midnight snacks later. An even more powerful and far more scary rendition of this story was depicted on a 13-episode special series of TV shows on the NBC channel called the series was Fear Itself. It ran for 1 year. They were trying to compete against cable companies back in 2008, and they really were scary shows. The specific episode out of the 13-show series was Skin and Bones. But once again, NBC sells us a tale of a skinwalker or a shapeshifter in place of the Wendigo. Terribly frightening. It was a very scary for a TV show. I was amazed they showed that on TV, but not what the true legend of the Wendigo was about. Not originally. Not in the native telling of their fears, anyhow.
Right.
Then you've got what they tell, if you follow the legends far enough, the story that Skin and Bones tells is a modification of a modern twist to the Wendigo tale of the natives, of the native peoples, and that is that they tell that in some cases, and this come about later in life, after, say, 1850 to 1900, that apparently the Wendigo can poison you, can corrupt you, and you eventually will turn into one, too. This was not always part of the Wendigo legend. This is a modern development out of the native people's tales. The older tales never gave the progression for you to become one. They, in effect, they went from being their own race at one time to suddenly a corruption, that like a disease that could be passed on, a possession. And again, that's what we've turned it into.
Which I think is where the term cannibal fell in, because in that definition, it is a human who is just basically diseased.
Right. I mean, again, if you're a human and you suddenly turn to eating people because you've become possessed, yes, that will be cannibalistic. But the old legends, they were not humans. They were
basically
began their time as a Wendigo, and they never converted humans to Wendigos, though they did eat humans. So again, they're more of a, you know, grizzly bears are never humans and never will be. And if they eat a person, they're carnivores, but they're not cannibal. Same kind of deal with a Wendigo.
They were giant carnivores.
Right. So on the Wendigo tie-in, such as The Manitou, another movie, this is from 1978, they predicted as a malicious native spirit that basically possessed a woman. They were all playing on the, not The Exorcist, the Amityville Horror. They were playing on the Amityville Horror theme of possession and spooks in the night and spiritual things. And again, everybody wants to tie this to native spirituality, but the Wendigo, or Wendigo, in original legend, was far more than a harassing, evil, malignant spirit. It was a malignant being. It was a giant that ate people. Spirits don't eat people. And again, that's the diversification that we're not realizing here. So again, the relative structure of this to the actual creature legend is minimal, if any at all. It was Hollywood. Then you have the movie Wendigo, or Wendigo, however you want to pronounce it, circa around 1978 also. Again, there were a lot of movies in 78 about Wendigos or Wendigos. This one was an ultra-low-budget film, more resembling a how-to-go-camping instructional video than a horror film, and I'm being kind to it. Trust me, it's a horrific, terrible video. It's more like for college kids did it on $195 and a case of beer. Then you have the movie Ravenous, which I think is, again, right there with Skin and Bones, probably one of the more frightening, fearsome of the Wendigo movies. It was a big budget, big actor, you know, A actor list type movie in 1999
that I never heard of till you were doing this.
Well, yeah,
podcast.
I saw it. Guy Pearce is actually he's a captain, I believe, in the cavalry. It's framed in around 1850, 1870, somewhere in that area. And I must say, it's an excellent horror movie. It's of the Don't Look Now variety, but again, we're still back to that Amityville Horror. You're possessed by the Wendigo.
Right.
Not that far, not the far more ancient story that came from the native peoples originally. So then we have Wendigo, a movie directed by Larry Fessenden, who's a great horror actor, in 2001. Now you should already realize, when you hear plug-in lines like very loosely based on the Anishinaabe legend of the Wendigo, you're already looking at a most likely modernized version that in effect or in reality is not the legend of the original creature that we're looking for.
So true.
This is no different. We're once again seeing the misty, phantasmic, spirit essence, oh look, you've been possessed, demon story that Hollywood wants to tell, or whatever, you know, you want to call it at work, going on with the Hollywood narrative, I guess. I don't know what else to call it. But you're not seeing the real creature.
No, not at all.
The original native peoples told us a different thing. So before you get too far down the Hollywood, you know, no, Hollywood has never created a monster other than, you know, gangbangers, I guess, that really was a valid monster.
Godzilla?
And I wish, that'd be cool. The original native peoples told us something different, though. The monster they tried to warn us about in their stories, they were warning us. They weren't creating these to scare kids. They didn't create things like that to scare kids into going to bed at night. They're trying to warn future generations about this definite threat there is to their existence.
Right.
It wasn't about a man starved into desperation that turns to cannibalism to live, taking with him forevermore the hunger for human flesh. No, this is not what the stories originally told us. It's not a story of demon possession either. Actually, the Native Americans had quite a few of those, and it never was equivalent to them in the beginning. You know, like Skin and Bones would tell us, or any of the other ones, where the victim becomes the monster by being bitten or being exposed or accepting them in. Again, I think in Skin and Bones, he says that it asked him if he wanted to live, and he said yes, and it said, then accept me in and you'll live, and he accept. Well, again, this is textbook demon possession, as it were.
Right.
Let's look at what the Algonquin Native peoples tell us about their own creature. The Wendigo is often depicted as a fearsome giant, but in different forms. They're said to most often be male, and they rub themselves against resinous trees such as pine or fir, then roll in sand, pebbles, rocks, and flint, especially flint, to give the impression to mankind they are made of stone and become impervious. This, in fact, could be where the Iroquois believe in stone giants or the Huron and Wyandot legends of the Strendu came from. In fact, C.M. Barbeau writes in his article Supernatural Beings of the Huron in a 1914 volume of American Anthropologist that the Wyandot Indians of Oklahoma described them as the following, quote unquote, "Some describe them as being half a tree tall or larger, and very barrel-chested and large in proportion. Their bodies were covered all over with flinty scales, which made them almost invulnerable. When the Wyandot, perchance, surprised one asleep, they would try to kill or suffocate him with linwood pillows, or shoot their arrows into the monster's armpit should his arm be raised. The Indians are reported one day to have discovered a giant woman sleeping along the shore of a lake. They had detected her, in fact, by the ripples on the surface of the water caused by her breathing. When a large party of warriors slew her by means of linwood pillows, the battle that resulted at the shore of the lake caused the whole lakeside to be strewn with large flint scales that covered her body previously. These monsters were cannibals, and in the old time, it sometimes happened that the terrified Indians would take their flight to the woods or having detected the presence of a giant in their neighborhood. The fingers of their human victims were used as charms that the Strendu used to detect the presence of other Indians," quote unquote. Now, this nearly identical retelling is offered in the 1996 book, The Wendigo's Return, A Northwood Story by Douglas Wood.
Which is a child's book.
It's a child's book, but he's telling it. Now, again, the preface to the book is amazing. He says when he was a boy, an old white-haired native woman of the Anishinaabe tribe told him this story, and he wanted to share it with children, that she had actually called him to the side and gave him this story. He claims he was told the story by the old woman of the Anishinaabe tribe when he was a young boy himself. By the way, they're a member or subgroup of the Algonquin. Mm-hmm. So, yet right. his book's telling of the creature is nearly identical to this published work in 1914 of the American Anthropologist Journal. And did you catch this jump I made? We were talking about the Algonquin, which are in Quebec and Ontario, Canada region, northern, very edge northern New York, up around from Buffalo, maybe over to upstate, and then we mentioned the Huron tribe, which is also Quebec, Ontario, New York area. But then suddenly I pull out of here, and I pulled it out from the Anthropology American Journal. Suddenly we reference a segment of the Wyandot tribe, and they're located in Oklahoma.
They're close to us.
Yeah, they're in Oklahoma. And so, wow, what a jump. This was done 100 years ago in an anthropology journal. They surely knew where all the tribes were allocated to, namely because they had already realized the similarities between sparkling, fast, armored, almost impossible to kill, giant people eaters referenced as in the Wendigo legends of the North, with this almost identical story of a creature of very similar description spoken of by the Wyandot in the middle of the U.S. Obviously, we have a wide-spanning creature being spoken of here by ancient tribal traditions that Europeans and still don't understand it for what it is.
Right.
So clearly what we're being told by these who are those who originated the legend of the Wendigo is that the Strindu was more or less the same southern creature that the Algonquin of eastern Canada and the far northeast U.S. referenced as the Wendigo. And furthermore, that the creature was not only a giant, and generally a stone giant as we know them now, who adorned themselves in tar or sap and then coated themselves in rocks to armor themselves against arrow and blade attacks, but that they are also frequently referenced as a cannibal. That this plays into another story we're going to be doing here in a month or so. We're going to look at a few of the giants known to the natives in the era back 400, 500, 600, 800 years ago. What you'll find is there are two kinds of creature described. One is always a non-human. He has hair, he has fur, he may be
at least two that we know of right now.
There's more than that, actually.
I know, but you mentioned two here, and that's the only two we're speaking of.
But there's also giants that are, in effect, giants, but they're perfectly formed humans. They have no hair other than the body hair a human normally has. They look like a human, but look, oh wow, they're 10, 12, 14, 18, 20 feet tall. Some of the Canaanites out of the Middle East have been referenced up to 36 feet tall.
Yeah.
Well, some of these human-like creatures that are gigantic in nature, the Indians may have, the Native Americans may naturally have used the word correctly in the word cannibal from where they would attack and eat other small 6 foot tall humans. But cannibal may not be being used properly when you're dealing with something that's more appropriate to a troll, an ogre, a Bigfoot, a Sasquatch.
A monster.
Where it would be a carnivore but not a cannibal. So which actually, to our understanding now, we would more accurately say that they are not all cannibals, but are carnivores who would eat humans if given the chance. In the case of the Wendigo, though, the descriptions are saying they were not human. Not in our current image.
That is the description that I understood.
Now, these are the oldest of the legends of the Huron, the Wyandot, the Iroquois, and the Algonquin native tribes. Let's not forget about the numerous legends of the giants that the Cherokee faced. And for those that aren't real familiar, the Cherokees, though they may be the civilized tribe now, and I have Cherokee in me, and Mouse has Cherokee in her, and it's amazing that with the knowledge of the Cherokee being the, quote, civilized tribe, very few realize more than 500 years ago, Cherokees were some of the most warlike of all the tribes. They were worse than the Apache. And far bigger. They estimate population could have been as great as 15 million on the east side of the U.S. 600 years ago. And they were networking with tribes all the way to the north, up past north of the Iroquois and the Algonquins, all the way down past and south of the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, and all of those in the south, down to the swamp natives down in the Florida region.
Right.
So they were well networked with other tribes, and they were feared among all. Because of their size and their ferocity, the Cherokee now. So these would be what we now call, in Cherokee, had to fight with these things. They fought what they describe as the red-haired giants that ate men, which also...
And again, that was covered in our ancient giants.
That comes up with the Navajo and the Hopi out here where we live.
North America.
Because that falls down to the cave where that they were challenged and... Literally, they were told surrender or die, and they built the smoky fire in the entrance of the cave and basically smoked them all to death. That happened out here, I think, in the late 1800s. So, and that'll come up more in our next show. I don't have the direct info in front of me on that right now. Not our next show, but one of our future, very soon.
We
had to break off the, because I've got so much in front of me. I tend to overload my plate sometimes.
I throw stuff at him.
Yeah, so. And she throws even more at me. Check this out for me.
Hey, while you're at it, look up this.
But anyhow, that legend has it the Cherokee hunted these great, gigantic, red-haired giants. They call them another tribe. Hunted them, but they were cannibals that ate men. Now, if they really were a tribe and they looked like humans and if they're eating men, okay, I can see where the Cherokee got the idea.
Definitely.
They're cannibals. They hunted them to extinction by the year 1600 because they were such a propensity of a threat to the Cherokees. Anytime they found Cherokees in the forest, in the woods, they were taking them, kidnapping them, killing them, eating them, and so forth. The Cherokee finally said, enough, we'll kill you all, and they did. So now as time goes on, or I should say as we come forward in time, From a millennia ago or more into modern times, a funny thing happens. The myth begins to change. As we've referenced before when talking about myths and legends, there's an event or process known as a Chinese rumor whisper. We brought it up in other shows.
It's getting to be a common
again, but
feature.
It's a common theme in a lot of these monster stories that you see a core tenet of a fact, of a kernel of truth, and it's wrapped around with 9,000 threads of falsehoods, fantasies, and myth. But if you strip off all the adders, you find the core truth down in the bottom that from there you can kind of go, oh, well, I see how that works now. And that's kind of where we keep coming to with these various venues we keep looking at, whether they're true giants, timber giants, trolls, Wendigo, they're all pointing back. And then you've got the tie-in from the myth side on the back of Lotenheim, the Frost Giants, Odin, and Yggdrasil.
Exactly.
So you've got the myth tying in, and that's coming from Europe, in the middle of Europe, no less, 1,000 years ago. And you're saying, wow, all these stories seem worldwide and interconnected. So as long as the whole crowd can see or hear the bulk story, they'll keep the same story. But once it becomes a handed-down story with limited people handing it on to the next generation of limited people, something unusual happens. The myth starts to change. It evolves, and it changes to where you can't track the truth. And this right. often happens when, if you're a tribe and you're seeing constant attacks from giants, you're going to go, oh, well, we all know about the monster Snarly over there. But then once everybody kills all the monster Snarlies, that first and second and third generation, you know, mom told me, dad told me, grandpa told me.
Well, you know, great Uncle Pete said.
Yeah, but then you get into the great Uncle Pete twice removed thing. And all of a sudden, with the distancing from the actual event, you also get something else. As humans, we're really bad about compartmentalizing things, even without the NSA. We get into only shaman or shaman pass the words down to the next level of shaman. Well, if you only have one shaman and he waits until he's almost dead to pass down a legend to the young new shaman is going to help the tribe, you get some of these extended things to where the old man may not be telling the young man the full truth, the straight truth, may not be telling him, like, now we're looking at what we're looking at, Chinese whispers.
Right.
He may not remember the story as he was originally told, so he's changed it to his own mindset by the time he got old and passes it to the next one. You go through 10 iterations of shaman to shaman spanning 300 or 400 years, and what comes out on the latest modern end may not be nothing like what went in on the beginning. He hasn't seen one. He's only passed the story down. How accurate is that story to when it started? And again, we're seeing that over and over again, a lot of these myths. So, but there is a grain of truth. That's the problem, getting to that grain of truth in the story. In most cases, you can actually track the base story or rumor or event to a time marker as a result of chasing the change point. In other words, when the Wendigo, it seems that there was something between the 1500s and the 1700s, something happened that few saw the Wendigo or their effects on populations anymore. It's like they just disappeared. And then the stories went from front page news where everybody knew it,
yeah,
to the shaman to shaman whispers. Thus, the fact of the story changed quickly after that point.
Right. Well, what happened? Did Wendigo die out? Like the true giants, did they simply head north away from the civilization of man? Did they retreat from sustained losses of living too close to men? We may never know. But what we can clearly see is that the timing is accurate to coincide with the settlement of North America by the new influx of Europeans as the legend started changing. The timing can't be ignored. Let's take a look at how it changed to, and which is even more telling.
Yeah, again, now let's take a look about that year 1700. A lot of things, matter of fact, if you go and listen to any of your anthropologists, they'll tell you they define the modern era of man as starting in the year 1516. And specifically, they've got it down that close to when something changed that ended the Dark Ages and brought about the Renaissance in the new modern era of man. And it happened in 1516.
Right.
Now, we didn't get to the United States. I mean, I know they say that Columbus discovered America in 1492, but in reality, he landed in the Indies. He never touched foot on the mainland U.S. in any way. you know, there were several explorers from Ponce de Leon was in Florida in the 1500s. You have the potential for Leif Erikson being up in the Nova Scotia and Maine region as early as 1000. These are things we even know about. Now, from that, about the year 1700, we started to see this change in the native people's story on Wendigo, which is very interesting. All of a sudden, we're seeing the change of the story that he's a giant, he's half the height of a tree. Now we're seeing it redefined to 6 to 9 feet.
Right.
Covered with hair, said to look emaciated, thin, gaunt, with a face that looks burned or blackened, as if it were frostbitten. It is reported, and this is a big curiosity, because the frostbitten thing really comes out of nowhere in the later rumors. It's not mentioned in the beginning. It is reported to have large teeth or tusks, claws, and glowing red eyes. In the original telling, he was a giant, he was a simpleton, rather easily fooled, but he was very fast, and he was a carnivore that ate men.
Yes.
So, again, it's almost like you're looking at two creatures. What happened? It is reported to have large teeth or tusks, claws, and glowing red eyes. And that's kind of unanimous through the beginning.
I want to know where that glowing eyes came from.
I think it was that they were seeing the reflection of the retinas in the eyes by torchlight or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's just what I call the resident reflectivity in the retinas.
That's a possibility.
And again, it has a great fear factor when you're looking at gigantic eyes and a giant that I can imagine it look like red dinner plates looking back at you. It'd be pretty frightening. You would definitely remember that. But
right.
See, we've kept the teeth and the tusk in the story, but the height changed. Again, this is not only changes from the older Ojibwa native tribe telling that the creature was half the height of a full-grown tree. Now we're looking at a starving 6 to 9 foot tall giant. But also times out to when climatologists say was the time of the last little ice age.
Right.
When most of Europe and a large portion of northern North America were actually glaciated or in a semi-ice age condition. In fact, in 1816, not only did the English Thames River in England freeze solid in the summer, it was still frozen into the summer, but frozen birds fell out of the sky in Montreal. It was so cold, and everything in Philadelphia that should be growing in June was still frozen solid.
Ironically, the volcano named Tambora in Indonesia that caused this extreme cooling event to happen also happened right at the end of the Little Ice Age, as it came to be called. But before it was over with, did it change the face of the Wendigo too? It sure sounds like it, at least to me. If it didn't kill the giant creature off with the help of many tribes who obviously hunted it and clearly hated them for their predator actions against tribal members, then the retreat of the cold and ice may have done the obvious, caused them to follow the cold further to the north into what we now know as the Arctic.
See, again, this sounds just like what we said happened with the true giants, that they actually got tired of man and ran to the Arctic.
So are they one and the same? What happened? To me, it sounds like this was the end of actual native peoples personally seeing the Wendigo creature, and with nothing but the stories left, these stories started to mutate into scary stories to entertain and to impress. Just like Hollywood, if you don't see them anymore, you don't remember them well enough to keep the story the same.
Well, again, actually, one of my first thoughts of it was that as I read this and as I put two and two together on this, it sounded like the last stories where the creature turned into this gaunt, sickly-looking thing with a burned face and burned feet, and it was a 6 to 9 foot creature versus half the height of a tree. It really sounded like a young or adolescent true giant, maybe left behind, maybe his parents died, maybe he had nobody to care for him, affected by this ice age, had may very possibly went into insanity, being starved to death, nothing to eat, and in just enraged insanity. They see it as a Wendigo still, or see it as the return of them, but he's crazed, he's insane now, he's starving to death, he's frozen, he's got frostbite, and it changed the end of the legend right as the last of them died off that men had seen
here. And that
here.
Very well could be the case.
So
it was
a dying death spasm of Wendigo, in effect, is what you're seeing. So as they disappear forever not to be seen, the new generations tell what they've heard. They retell the old stories and what they think could be feasible. Forget a few details, and as a result, the myth grows. It undulates, but is it still accurate? Normally, no. This is exactly how we can state that Bigfoot is as real as any silverback gorilla. I mean, the story stays the same. We get more detail, but nothing conflicts, nothing changes. You know, Bigfoot's not flying around with wings because the myth is growing or mutating. It's just more flushing out of the actual creature itself. So just as we can undeniably state that the Wendigo does not live around humans in the southern regions anymore, at least south of, say, 50 degrees north latitude, are they still around? Do they still walk the earth? Quite possibly. But as the timber giants we have discussed before, it's quite likely that the Wendigo left mankind forever at about the same time the timber giants did, seeking solitude in the far northern extremes away from man, as opposed to constantly fighting man, often losing to him, and as a result of trying to live near him, constantly being beat out. He was not sufficient prey. Mankind wasn't sufficient prey to the Wendigo to warrant the threat he has also posed to them simultaneously. So what sounds like many tales to the uninitiated, in fact, may be one and the same creature, as we've just said. The Wendigo may, in fact, be the timber giant, which may, in fact, be the Strindu, which we ourselves once knew to be a mountain troll 1,000 years ago, which later became known as a stone giant because we weren't familiar with them anymore, and while they are a simpleton, they figured out that they could roll in tar and roll on rocks and actually have some body armor to fight off broadheads and blades and swords of that nature.
They found out that that was the way to protect their flesh.
Right. They found out that, hey, we're bigger and stronger than little puny man as long as his sharp steel or sharp iron blades and points don't puncture us and kill us.
Right.
We can beat all of them. And again, so it's a natural logic chain that happened there. Is all this where Mary Shelley got her idea for the end of Frankenstein? Again, you're looking at exactly the same story put in the guise of a Frankenstein zombie brought back to life. He's a monster. In the end of the book, he flees to the Arctic to live out his, quote, very long, unknown length of life, floating on an iceberg in the Arctic Ocean. That was the last image you're seeing of Frankenstein in the book, in Mary Shelley's Prometheus Unbound original Frankenstein book, away from the terrors of man. I mean, except in this story, there is no iceberg, but a vast, desolate region of the North Arctic regions of the world where men seldom visit, and when they do, they are either so busy, they are either like building a pipeline or doing oil or whatever. They're so busy working, they don't notice what's around them in the nature or indoors, away from the freezing, frigid 40 below zero temperatures, they can't observe what may be going on outside in the dark, loathing them, hungry, waiting for an opportunity. If we look at where our modern reports on our timber giants come from, they are in the last regions of the world where men seldom go.
Right.
Are the timber giants also the Wendigo? Well, are they similar but different? Look like different races of similar species.
Possible.
You know, from the Montana Bitterroot region in winter to the Illiamna region of Alaska to the northern regions of the Canadian Shield around Hudson Bay, we hear that the true giants, those larger than any Bigfoot, occupy these same areas. And here we, again, we're always met with that myth on the backside of Yggdrasil and Lotenheim. Your frost giants, your ice giants.
Right.
That's exactly the territory they went to. And maybe they came to it from it and come down south right at the end of the glaciation of the last true ice age 10,000 years ago. Maybe they tried to make a go of it and found that humans were so volatile and determined to hunt them to extinction, they went back to the ice. not many reports, one here, one there, across a decade of time. One person sees a 19-foot-tall hominid walking across a plain during a thunderstorm, taking 20-foot strides with each step with a pace like that. You could cover miles each night.
Oh, yeah.
If there are hundreds, if not thousands of years old, maybe they live to be 1,000. What if? They wouldn't need to have a really high reproduction rate if that's the case. They would know where to seek shelter each day, away from the troublesome eyes of man. Which size is more accurate? A Bigfoot-sized creature, 6 to 9 feet tall, or was that an adolescent that was one of the last seen? Or is a giant that is half the height of the tree more correct? If Wendigos are true giants, then are they not the trolls, but possibly the ancient European equivalent to the troll? What if they're an ogre? A fiend known to eat men? It's an ogre and a troll were like cousins, but not quite. They were of different structure. Forget Shrek. An ogre was a troll squared with bad attitude and horrible table manners. Were the Wendigo the equivalent of an ogre if a mountain giant is a troll? Again, these are questions we have no idea even where to begin looking for some of this information. Few places remain that they could still be kings of nature as they once were, but dangerous is the path for those who venture too deep into the real forests of the world. The Wendigo was said to be voracious and insatiable, and since first reported it was said to be few in number, but few were quite enough, it would seem.
Are giants out there still? Do 20-foot tall creatures with appetites to match still walk the earth? If they do they still hunger for men, or despise them forevermore, with full intention to avoid them at all costs? What happens if we can't or don't avoid them? And what happens if they rethink their self-imposed solitude and return to reclaim what they left long ago?
Yeah, I mean, one of the greatest personal questions while working on this whole topic has simply been, are we looking at the legend of what in fact was a starving, sick, or deranged timber giant, possibly more than one, possibly an adolescent, who, again, possibly and single-handedly caused the creation of such a legend as Wendigo?
A lot of possibilities.
I mean, if they live 300, 500, 1,000 years per being, per creature, then one that had gone insane or became sick and couldn't heal, and apparently didn't die very quickly, could easily have caused such a frightened legend to become reality among the native peoples. Once again, the potential for logic makes another way out there story seem very frighteningly possible once you dig deep enough.
So many, many questions, and even after all this time, so few answers. But here at the Rat Files, we are unfortunately out of time tonight. As always, we leave you to provide the answers and draw your own conclusions to many of these questions. We've told you what we know. It's now up to you to choose what to do with the knowledge from there. So, for the Rat Files, this is the Mouse.
And Lance.
And we're out of here.